The Risk Profession by Donald E. Westlake. Mr. Henderson called me into his office my third day back in Tangiers. That was a day and a half later than I'd expected. Roving claims investigators for Tangiers Mutual Insurance Corporation don't usually get to spend more than 36 consecutive hours at home base. Henderson was jovial but stern. That meant he was happy with the job I'd just completed, and that he was pretty sure I'd find some crooked shenanigans on this next assignment. That didn't please me. I'm basically a plain living type, and I hate complications. I almost wished for a second there that I was back on Fire and Theft in Greater New York. But I knew better than that. As a roving claim investigator, I avoided the more stultifying paperwork inherent in this line of work, and had the additional luxury of an expense account nobody ever questioned. It made working for a living almost worthwhile. When I was settled in the chair beside his desk, Henderson said, "That was good work you did on Luna, Ged. Saved the company a pretty pence." I smiled modestly and said, "Thank you, sir," and reflected to myself, for the thousandth time, that the company could do worse than split that saving with the guy who'd made it possible. Me, in other words. "Got a tricky one this time, Ged," said my boss. He had done his back patting. Now we got down to business. He peered keenly at me, or at least as keenly as a round-faced, tiny-eyed fat man can peer. "What do you know about the Risk Profession Retirement Plan?" he asked me. "I've heard of it," I said truthfully. "That's about all." He nodded. "Most of the policies are sold off-planet, of course. It's a form of insurance for non-insurables. Spaceship crews, asteroid prospectors, people like that." "I see," I said unhappily. I knew right away this meant I was going to have to go off Earth again. I'm a 1G boy all the way. Gravity changes get me in the solar plexus. I get G-sick at the drop of an elevator. "Here's the way it works," he went on, either not noticing my sad face or choosing to ignore it. "The client pays a monthly premium. He can be as far ahead or as far behind in his payments as he wants. The policy has no lapse clause, just so he's all paid up by the target date. The target date is a retirement age, 45 or above, chosen by the client himself. After the target date, he stops paying premiums, and we begin to pay him a monthly retirement check. The amount determined by the amount paid into the policy. His age at retiring, and so on. Clear?" I nodded, looking for the gimmick that made this a paying proposition for good old Tangiers Mutual. "The double RP, that's what we call it around the office here, assures the client that he won't be reduced to panhandling in his old age, should his other retirement plans fall through. For belt prospectors, of course, this means the big strike, which may be 1 in 100 find. For the man who never does make that big strike, this is something to fall back on. He can come home to Earth and retire, with a guaranteed income for the rest of his life." I nodded again, like a good company man. "Of course," said Henderson, emphasizing this point with an upraised, chubby finger. "These men are still uninsurables. This is a retirement plan only, not an insurance policy. There is no beneficiary other than the client himself." And there was the gimmick. I knew a little something of the actuarial statistics concerning uninsurables, particularly belt prospectors. Not many of them lived to be 45, and the few who would survive the belt and come home to collect the retirement wouldn't last more than a year or two. A man who's spent the last 20 or 30 years on low-G asteroids just shrivels up after a while when he tries to live on Earth. It needed a company like Tangiers Mutual to dream up a racket like that. The term uninsurables to most insurance companies means those people whose jobs or habitats make them too likely as prospects for obituaries. To Tangiers Mutual, uninsurables are people who have money the company can't get at. "Now," said Henderson importantly, "we come to the problem at hand." He ruffled his up-to-now neat in-basket and finally found the folder he wanted. He studied the blank exterior of this folder for a few seconds, pursing his lips at it, and said, "One of our clients under the double RP was a man named Jafe McCann." "Was?" I echoed. He squinted at me, then nodded at my sharpness. "That's right. He's dead." He sighed heavily and tapped the folder with all those pudgy fingers. "Normally, that would be the end of it. However, this time there are complications." "Naturally. Otherwise he wouldn't be telling me about it." But Henderson couldn't be rushed, and I knew it. I kept the alert look on my face, and thought of other things, while waiting for him to get to the point. 2 weeks after Jafe McCann's death," Henderson said, "we received a cash return form on his policy." "A cash return form? I'd never heard of such a thing. It didn't sound like anything Tangiers Mutual would have anything to do with. We never return cash." "It's something special in this case," he explained. "You see, this isn't an insurance policy. It's a retirement plan. And the client can withdraw from the retirement plan at any time and have 75% of his paid-up premiums returned to him. It's, the law in plans such as this." "Oh," I said. That explained it. A law that had snuck through the World Finance Code Commission while the insurance lobby wasn't looking. "But you see the point," said Henderson. "This cash return form arrived 2 weeks after the client's death." "You said there weren't any beneficiaries," I pointed out. "Of course, but the form was sent in by the man's partner, one Ab Carpin. McCann left a handwritten will bequeathing all his possessions to Carpin. Since, according to Carpin, this was done before McCann's death, the premium money cannot be considered part of the policy, but as part of McCann's cash on hand. And Carpin wants it." "It can't be that much, can it?" I asked. I was trying my best to point out to him that the company would spend more than it would save if it sent me all the way out to the asteroids, a prospect I could feel coming, and one which I wasn't ready to cry hosanna over. "McCann died," Henderson said ponderously, "at the age of 56. He had set his retirement age at 60. He took out the policy at the age of 34, with monthly payments of 50 credits. Figure it out for yourself." I did, in my head, and came up with a figure of 13,200 credits. 75% of that would be 9,900 credits. Call it 10,000 credits even. I had to admit it. It was worth the trip. "I see," I said sadly. "Now," said Henderson, The conditions, the circumstances of McCann's death are somewhat suspicious, and so is the cash return form itself. There's a chance it's a forgery? One would think so, he said. But our handwriting experts have worn themselves out with that form, comparing it with every other single scrap of McCann's writing they can find. And their conclusion is that not only is it genuinely McCann's handwriting, but it is McCann's handwriting at age 56. So McCann must have written it, I said. Under duress, do you think?
I have no idea, said Henderson complacently. That's what you're supposed to find out.
Oh, there's just one more thing. I did my best to make my ears perk.
I told you that McCann's death occurred under somewhat suspicious circumstances.
Yes, I agreed. You did.
McCann and Carpin, he said, have been partners, unincorporated, of course, for the last 15 years. They had found small, rare metal deposits now and then, but they had never found that one big strike all the belt prospectors waste their lives looking for. Not until the day before McCann died.
Aha, I said. Then they found the big strike.
Exactly.
And McCann's death?
Accidental.
Sure, I said. What proof have we got?
None. The body is lost in space, and law is few and far between that far out.
So all we've got is this guy Carpin's word for how McCann died. Is that it?
That's all we have, so far.
Sure. And now you want me to go on out there and find out what's cooking, and see if I can maybe save the company 10,000 credits.
Exactly,
said Henderson. The copter took me to the spaceport west of Cairo, and there I boarded the good old ship Demeter for Luna City and points out. I loaded up on G-sickness pills, and they worked fine. I was sick as a dog. By the time we got to Atronic City, my insides had grown resigned to their fate. As long as I didn't try to eat, my stomach would leave me alone. Atronic City was about as depressing as a Turkish bath with all the lights on. It stood on a chunk of rock a couple of miles thick, and it looked like nothing more in this world than a welder's practice range. From the outside, Atronic City is just a derby-shaped dome of nickel iron, black and kind of dirty-looking. I suppose a transparent dome would have been more fun, but the builders of the company cities in the asteroids were businessmen, and they weren't concerned with having fun. There's nothing to look at outside the dome but chunks of rock and the blackness of space anyway, and you've got all this cheap iron floating around in the vicinity, and all a dome's supposed to do is keep the air in. Besides, though the belt isn't as crowded as a lot of people think, there is quite a lot of debris rushing here and there, bumping into things, and a transparent dome would just get all scratched up, not to mention punctured. From the inside, Atronic City is even jollier. There's the top level, directly under the dome, which is mainly parking area for scooters and tuggers of various kinds, plus the office shacks of the assayer's office, the entry authority, the industry troopers, and so on. The next three levels have all been burned into the bowels of the planetoid. Level two is the Atronics plant, and a noisy plant it is. Level three is the shopping and entertainment area. Grocery stores, clothing stores, movie theaters, and bars. And level four is housing. Two rooms and kitchen for the unmarried, four rooms and kitchen, plus one room for each child, for the married. all of these levels have one thing in common. Square corners painted olive drab. The total effect of the place is suffocating. You feel like you're stuck in the middle of a stack of packing crates. Most of the people living in Atronic City work, of course, for International Atronics Incorporated. The rest of them work in the service occupations, running the bars and grocery stores and so on. They keep the company employees alive and relatively happy. Wages come high in the places like Atronic City. Why not? The raw materials come practically for free. And as for working conditions, well, take a for instance. How do you make a vacuum tube? You fiddle with the innards and surround it all with glass. And how do you get the air out? No problem, boy. There wasn't any air in there to begin with. At any rate, there I was at Atronic City. That was as far as Demeter would take me. Now, while the ship went on to Ludlum City and Chemisant City and the other asteroid business towns, my two suitcases and I dribbled down the elevator to my hostelry on level 4. Have you ever taken an elevator ride when the gravity is practically non-existent? Well, don't. You see, the elevator manages to sink faster than you do. It isn't being lowered down to level 4, it's being pulled down. What this means is that the suitcases have to be lashed down with the straps provided, and you and the operator have to hold on tight to the hand grips placed here and there around the wall. Otherwise, you'd clonk your head on the ceiling. But we got to level 4 at last, and off I went with my suitcases and the operator's directions. The suitcases weighed about 1/2 ounce each out here, and I felt as though I weighed the same. Every time I raised a foot, I was sure I was about to go sailing into a wall. Local citizens eased by me, their feet occasionally touching the iron pavement as they soared along, and I gave them all dirty looks. Level 4 was nothing but walls and windows. The iron floor went among these walls and windows in a straight line, bisecting other streets at perfect right angles, and the iron ceiling 16 feet up was lined with a double row of fluorescent tubes. I was beginning to feel claustrophobic already. The Chalmers Hotel, named for an Atronics vice president, had received my advance registration, which was nice. I was shown to a second-floor room. Nothing on level 4 had more than 2 stories, and was left to unpack my suitcases as best I may. I had decided to spend a day or two at Atronic City before taking a scooter out to Ab Karpin's claim. Atronic City had been Karpin's and McCann's home base. All of McCann's premium payments had been mailed from here, and the normal mailing address for both of them was GPO Atronic City. I wanted to know as much as possible about Ab Karpin before I went out to see him, and Atronic City seemed like the best place to get my information. But not today. Today, my stomach was very unhappy, and my head was on sympathy strike. Today, I was going to spend my time exclusively in bed, trying not to float up to the ceiling. End of part 1.